Get in the car.
Are you mad at us?
I bet your little red butts I'm mad at you.
Oh, bitch, bitch, bitch.
I said you could open a lemonade stand, and what did you do?
We did open a stand.
Yeah, but nobody wanted lemonade, so we switched over to selling cool, refreshing gin and tonics. I spent the whole day servicing happy, thirsty crowds.
Except you don't have a liquor license and you're minors. I had to pay a $2,500 fine to get you out of jail.
Oh, bitch, bitch, bitch. Here, let me unroll some greenbacks. Here's your $25 in return.
Wow.
And here you go. A little extra for your inconvenience. You, buy yourself something nice, pal.
Rashi, Jesus, how much money did you guys make?
That is not of concern to you, pal. Hey, reach under the seat.
What?
You look so hot and thirsty.
Yeah.
So we hid an extra G&T in the car for you. It's there in the Tiny Toons thermos.
What? Wow. I really shouldn't have any in the car, but it does look good. Maybe I'll just take a little sip. Nice.
Hello, 911. I'd like to report a drunk driver.
Oh, goddammit. Put that phone down.
Hey, you're kind of being a pain in the ass. I had to get rid of you somehow.
The podcast that you're about to listen to has Spike and Tony and Allison and Spencer and Paul and Ezra and Emily and a whole room full of people. And it's from a couple weeks back. So this is our blanket apology for any inappropriateness that may come on here due to our laziness in editing because, no offense, Ezra, but because we have been worried about the site.
We're still catching up, folks. Sorry.
And then also our blanket apology for anything that sounds outdated, any announcements that were made and stuff, because we're just finally back now and we didn't want you to miss it because they're so cool and interesting. So
yeah.
Enjoy.
Hey everybody, it's Paul Dini. Misty, unfortunately, is still under the weather. However, we are back with a second part of our big interview with Spike Brandt and Tony Cervone. We had a great response from last week, and this week we're joined again by Spike's son, Spencer, and by Tony's lovely wife, Allison Abate, a tremendous animation producer who has worked on such films as Fantastic Mr. Fox, Corpse Bride, and the upcoming Frankenweenie, and Space Jam, I guess. Is that where you guys know each other from?
Where it all began.
Space Jam? Welcome. Allison, so how did you get involved with Space Jam, with Warner Brothers and animation in general? You're new, so you get the first question here.
I guess I had worked with Ron Tipp, who was producing the animation on that, and he brought me on board. I knew nothing about basketball or the Looney Tunes at the time, so it was an adventure, but I loved it, and I met Tony, so it was
the great.
Best job of my life.
Awesome. And are you having fun on Frankenweenie?
A lot of fun, yes.
I saw the models at Comic-Con, and they look terrific.
They're really, it's going to be a lovely movie. You're going to love it.
Yeah.
It's been fun. And it's finished, which is the best part.
Right. All done, huh?
Yeah, so, yep.
When is it, first week of October?
Yeah, October 5th we open, yeah.
Great.
So, yeah, it's going to be fun.
Awesome. So, hey guys. So, last week we were talking about Scooby and Dodgers and all the stuff that we've worked on. And
the shows that never... All the things we worked on that never became shows.
And that's we had a lot of interesting feedback on that. Everybody was going like, a Goonies show? No, why didn't that happen? I want a Goonies show. And
we ended up with a great poster out of it, though, so.
Yeah. But Goonies and Harley and Ivy, people really wanted to see those. And
well, never say never.
Yeah. You know, I should drag the Harley and Ivy artwork out of mothballs. I think I've got at least copies of it somewhere. Should take it back to Warner's and they'll look at it and they go, hey, this is great. Who can we get to work on this? Not you. Get out of here. But anyway, it was fun. You're doing Looney Tunes now, too. Like the second season or third season on that?
Well, our first season's already aired and we're well underway on the second season. And from what we understand, the second season will come back to Cartoon Network in the fall.
Have they given you any word about, you know, keeping the franchise going after a second season, or is that one of those things?
You know, we're really deep into the second season now and not talking about what would come after that. But, you know, with the Looney Tunes characters, there's always something in the works. And,
right.
You know, it's something that's very important in a studio. So, obviously, there's someone thinking about things mm-hmm. at all times.
Looney Tunes will exist in some form or another throughout eternity.
It's perennial.
As long as hunters chase rabbits, I suppose. Well, that was it was fun working on some shorts with you guys way back when. We worked on a take on Looney Tunes. What was it, like 12 years ago? Longer than that, I guess. Like 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah, we worked on a take where, you know, we came up with a bunch of different short ideas. And those were a lot of fun.
I went through some files recently, and some of those went from just premises that never got farther than premises to they got pretty far along.
Yeah,
actually.
I mean, I remember you did, you wrote basically three shorts. I mean, I don't know if they were completely script form, but
they were at least like really comprehensive.
Ralph Phillips one, and
God, I forgot about the Ralph Phillips one.
The Wile E. Coyote one, I still think about that from time to time.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, like they were fairly detailed as far as outlines go, because we had talked about what they were, and I think that, I guess the idea was to take the outline and then just storyboard it, you know, and just use that as sort of the springboard for the...
Yeah, those were kind of thought of as, and you know, we did a lot of the Duck Dodgers episodes that way, where we would write outlines... You guys would write outlines.
Yeah, me and Tom Mitten, yeah.
And then we would go right to storyboard. And then after Spike and I kind of roughed a board out, you and Tom would kind of jump back in and work on dialogue or come up with new ideas. Like,
yeah, we would have those things kind of pinned up. And
yeah.
They were all done on Post-it notes. And we would have dialogue... Some of the stuff that had been in the outline, or some of the lines that we had written in,
mm-hmm.
And then you guys would come in and sort of go through and do a punch up pass on it. So.
Right, yeah, then Friday nights you'd pitch it to Sam.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
Sam would come in late Friday nights, yeah, and then that would be
whatever
the
we
Dodgers
did that
pitch.
Week.
Yeah,
and I mean, it was fun working that way, and it worked for Duck Dodgers, especially for that 11-minute format where. It really was organic, where everyone's kind of contributing, and not just like you play your part and then you go away and then hand the baton off to someone else who takes it to the next level. In those days, and then on that series, you know, there was a lot of back and forth where, hey, come in, you know, come in here, take a look at this. We worked ourselves into a corner. How do we get out of it? Or like, what do you think of this line? Or what do you think of that line? Or this line's got to be improved. Or this bit's got to be, you know, so it was always like.
Yeah.
Sometimes I would board stuff that didn't have the lines in. Like, I didn't know what the lines were going to be, but I knew what the beat was. And so I would just go, and then he needs to say something that sounds smart here. And then it was pretty funny that. You know, like you or Tom would come in and go, and then he says this here, and this here.
Yeah.
It actually kind of works. So.
Got to get Mitten in here at some point. Yeah. You know, I miss his low threatening growl. but I do remember that. And sometimes, like, he'd give me pages and say, well, it's sort of like this. And I would take it back to my office and I'd break out Post-its and I'd do either write dialogue or else I'd do like, little stick figures or something like that.
Yeah, you would actually sometimes provide some of the rough storyboards.
I remember like the new cadet, like this one thing where he's on the toilet or something, and he's like, you know, reaching
in the montage.
Yeah, like he's reaching for some toilet paper, and this hand comes in, and he just goes, "Thank you," and it's the girl, and she's sitting there in the can next to her, and stuff like that. Little bits here and there. I think it's, I'm not sure whose line it is, but there's something pinned up on my fridge that has been there since, I think, you know, we worked on the cartoon. It's my favorite line of dialogue from the Dodgers series, where it's the pirate one, and it's Dodgers and the cadet and Marvin all escaping, and Dodgers has a line like, well, we failed our mission, but nevertheless, a job well done. And I think that's about all cartoons, you know?
We failed. I hate you, old friend. I hate you.
That was was fun. That was a really cool way of working, and that was like with the Looney Tunes shorts that never got made. That was sort of it. That Wile E. Coyote one. Man, if we had made that, Chuck would have exploded out of his grave. Like, how dare you? It broke every rule in, you know, all of his canon sacred rules about Roadrunner. It violated everything. It opened like a regular one with a coyote trying to catch the Roadrunner and then winding up getting snared in his own trap. And you think that's the end. The Roadrunner goes off and then the Roadrunner gets hungry. And it's like, what does a Roadrunner eat? And then it's sort of like the Roadrunner... We looked it up in a book. They eat lizards and snakes and stuff. So he was trying to catch a lizard that was faster than he was. And he just sort of went like, poof, like he never even saw him in one. You never saw a movie. He was just suddenly in one place after another. And the Roadrunner had to try and trap him.
It's like Nightcrawler.
Yeah, yeah. And he's got these scrawny little wings. And he's trying to raise a safe with the I don't know, with some weird thing. And then he got slaughtered. Then the lizard ran off. And then the lizard got hungry. And it's like one, you know, sequence of desert animals all trying to eat each other. And I remember it ended with, like, he was trying to eat a fly, and the fly kept getting away from him. And I think the last part of it was the Roadrunner, Coyote, and the lizard were all bandaged up in traction, eating tacos at a stand out in the desert. And the fly comes in and eats all their food and flies off flying, and then it hits a windshield of a bus. And just to show that no one is spared. Something like that. It was like...
Everybody's got their Roadrunner. I think that was the...
Yeah. There are probably about a dozen animation fans who are saying, that's the most terrible idea I've ever heard in my life. I'm so glad they never made that.
Well, you know, we've worked on a lot of Looney Tunes stuff over the years, and yeah. We've done a lot of, you know, all the projects in different ways. Even on Space Jam,
yeah.
You know, we had a script, and we changed a lot during the script. Like, the whole... You know, the whole basketball game, I think, was just a line in the script. You know, Michael Jordan and the Toon Squad play basketball.
It's yeah.
Like, all right, we had stuff to do.
So you added gag after gag and have to plot out a whole basketball game.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And that was, I mean, and other parts were scripted. And now, like, the Looney Tunes show that we work on now is very scripted. But,
yeah.
You know, the format of that show is kind of a traditional sitcom format. And it kind of... needs to be that way. Like, it would be difficult to
right.
just do a it would it's be difficult really difficult to do
this
do.
Way
yeah, yeah, but to do a 22 minute long show from an outline is not really a great idea.
Well, that's kind of the rule with all half hour animation. A lot of it is, I'd say most of it is scripted up front. You know, Family Guy, American Dad, and The Simpsons and
yeah well if
like
you're gonna
that.
Do like I said, a 22 minute long
yeah.
continuous A, B, and C story that yeah. are all kind of interwoven. You know, we work the Hugh and Rachel and Larry, they work really hard on these scripts to
yeah.
and get them really kind of well-honed and well-polished before we ever start drawing them.
They have like an encyclopedic knowledge of the characters. And,
Well, I mean, the characters in the Looney Tunes show are kind of like they're true to their core, but they're also kind of like written for this show. Like, I think these characters are really kind of sturdy characters and very durable. They could kind of stand up in all kinds of different scenarios. Like, you could have Daffy Duck in a space show and like Duck Dodgers.
Sure.
You could have Daffy Duck in classic cartoons.
Uh-huh.
And you could have Daffy Duck in kind of a sitcom style show. And they all work because Daffy Duck is such a strong character.
Sure, sure.
I mean, you could have Daffy Duck in a feature film and he can hold that too. Like, it's just the characters have been around for a reason, you know.
And I mean, this goes back to Duck Dodgers a little mm-hmm. bit, but the characters seemed so alive that sometimes you'd be sitting there with, you know, a stack of Post-it notes and drawing something, and then you would just sit there and start chuckling because the characters were doing something. You were just trying yeah. to record what they were doing. Like,
yeah.
like you were creating something, but it seemed more like you were just watching it happen and trying to draw it down as quickly as you can. So, I mean, that's a real testament to the characters when they're that alive that they're
yeah, they have a life of their own, and all we really do is just try and record it as best we can. Like, you know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't even have to think about what's Daffy Duck going to do in a long line at the grocery store. I mean, you could just just it starts yeah. playing itself out in your head. And yeah. I always think that Daffy Duck and characters like that, these Looney Tunes characters, are always funniest in situations that you could really relate to and things that drive you nuts.
Right.
You know, that's why they're like, that's when they're at their best. You don't need some kind of big, goofy, gimmicky plot. Just
right.
all their comedy comes out of their character, comes out of who they are and how they react to things that we can relate to.
Right, right. I mean, I think they suffer when they're paired up against characters who are trying to be goofier than they are. I think yeah. they work best with straight man type characters, you know, whether they're other cartoon characters or in a live action scenario. You can't out funny Bugs Bunny. You can't out crazy Daffy Duck. You just sort of have to, like, let them do their business.
Yeah, and just let them go. Wind them up and let them go, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a favorite Bugs or Daffy? Well, it's both. Tony, do you have a favorite version, iteration of them? Whether it's a classic one or a modern one? Or
I'm going to, you know, I like and appreciate all kinds of things and all kinds of different directors and all their different takes. And I think Spike and I are going to wind up saying the same thing. But, you know, when it comes down to what are my favorite Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck cartoons, there are 90% of them were directed by Chuck Jones.
Mm-hmm. Spike?
Yeah, no, I would agree. And it's kind of weird because as a kid watching those cartoons, most of the time the head credits were all cut off of those things. So it was just like there was a title card and then you were right into it. And, you know, it was only later on that you learned really who the directors and of each of these cartoons were. And, you know, I was surprised. It's like, oh, wow, a lot of my favorite ones are you know, directed by Charles M. Jones or Chuck Jones. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I've always liked his take on the characters the best, even though... you know, there's wonderful Friz Freleng cartoons
sure.
and, you know, Bob Clampett cartoons and McKimson cartoons. But always the Jones one seemed to...
Yeah, and I think I went through a phase where I was, like, rebelling against the Jones cartoons and
yeah.
and wanted to, like, the craziness of the Clampett cartoons and all that. But, and you know, I love those Clampett cartoons. I love some McKimson Bugs Bunny cartoons. You
yeah.
know, like, all of those directors had brilliant shining moments, but when it comes down to it, like, really, what do I keep returning to throughout, you know, the many years we've worked on this stuff? It's it mm-hmm. usually really is the Jones stuff.
I like any Bugs cartoon where he has to work a little bit, like in the Jones, some of the Jones cartoons, you know, I love Jones, he's terrific, but in some of the later ones, he's just a little too Bugs is too all powerful, you know, he's not in trouble at any point in the cartoon. But some of the late 40s, early 50s ones, like the one with the little penguin, the one with...
Yeah, I mean, he certainly had a sweet spot there from, like,
yeah.
48 to probably, like, you know, 54, 55.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, then after that, he does have some great cartoons in there, too.
Right.
But there is kind of that middle period where it's like, wow, he's really firing on all cylinders and
yeah,
everything is really
the first great. Marvin cartoon was a Hairdevil hair or something like that. I think
Hairway to the Stars.
It's the very first one where
I think it might be Hairdevil hair, right?
Is it Hairdevil
yeah,
hair?
It's the one where he's taken kicking and screaming and put on
yeah,
the
yeah.
on the rocket. I love that because he's got a place to go emotionally. He's scared and then he sees he's getting 8 carrots and he's okay, and then he gets shaken up on the trip and everything. And I like, and that's why I like the little penguin cartoons, is it's like, oh, I got to take this annoying bird all the way halfway across the world and dump him somewhere. And even the, like the little gangster one, like the Babyface Finster yeah. one, I kind of like that one. I like any Bugs or the Bully for Bugs, you know, or the bulls, you know, kind of right. beating the crap out of him early on there. I like those. I have a fondness for Tashlin, for Daffy, like... Nasty Quacks, I think, is yeah. like probably my top two all favorite, you know. And I don't know what the other Daffy cartoon would be, but I love that version of Daffy. The little, He's almost like a mischievous
That's the
sprite.
One with the little girl who gets Daffy as a gift.
Yeah.
And then he's raised from the baby duckling into the obnoxious adult.
All he does is piss off that dad.
where he's like, they're at the breakfast table and he's
what
just like,
party,
yeah,
what
a party. Thought it would never end. He's just like eating his toast and...
Yeah. Charlie kicked a cup and the whole thing started all over again. And the dad's just sitting there like...
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's and that like one cartoon's like, I always connected that scene at the breakfast table with that scene at the of the Marx Brothers when they're eating. I don't know if it's Night at the Opera or if it's what is that the one? Yeah, it might be Night at the Opera. There's one where they're all eating breakfast all at the same time, and it's like the
room service.
Is it room service where it's like the like best choreographed scene where they're
and Harpo just keeps eating one pea after a time.
Yeah, and it's just like pure manic energy.
Definitely. Well, that was, you know, Tashlin, he kind of moved over from cartoons into live action, and he brought a lot of that sensibility with him when he did those like, Bob Hope pictures and things like that. So, yeah, Jones is, I don't know, I think he's on the top of everybody's list. He's terrific.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, where everyone says, that's, you know, but what are you going to say? What can you do? There's really no denying it. The guy made some great cartoons. Yeah. A lot of great cartoons.
They all did. They all had a chance to come in and kind of experiment. And
they had a chance to make good cartoons.
No.
They had a chance to make some cartoons that didn't work at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, it was, and they had a lot of characters to try out and to pair in different ways. And the directors used the characters in different ways.
Right, and I think that that's the difference between Warner Brothers and a lot of other studios' films that continues to this day is like, you know, every director had their own crack at these characters and kind of pushed them in different ways, and it didn't really, it only made them stronger. And I think that, you know, we're still doing the same thing. The Bugs Bunny in a Looney Tunes show is a different Bugs Bunny than a Chuck Jones or a McKimson or a Clampett or a Freely.
Right.
I mean, but it's still Bugs Bunny, and... It's just, this is our take on it, you know, and we're lucky enough that we've been around long enough that we've taken a bunch of different swings at these things over the year and had a number of different takes on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, it'll continue to happen. There'll be someone else is next in line, and then there's someone next in line behind them. And like I said, the characters are durable enough and resilient enough to handle it no matter how hard we try to wreck them.
Yeah, 20, 30 years, I'll be the 100th anniversary of Looney Tunes or something, and then a whole new crew will have them. And we'll be doing
They'll be cool,
stuff.
Like mind cartoons that only play inside your brain.
Yeah. We'll bring back characters like Cool Cat and stuff like that.
Right. Sniff the 22nd century return of Sniffles.
Yeah, there you go. That was Cool Cat. What was it? Favorite character of Mittens. He kept putting him in Sylvester and Tweety Mysteries.
What's the Colonel Rimshot?
Rimfire.
Yeah. And Cool Cat.
Yeah. It's like everybody wanted to remake Snagglepuss or something, or, you know, an animal running around and a hunter after them, you know, it's comedy gold, except people don't hunt anymore, really, so.
Are there any Looney Tunes characters that you guys haven't had a chance to play with yet, that, like, older or supporting roles, like you're just talking, like, or a Chicken Hawk or something that you haven't had a chance to really toy with?
We've
used an awful lot.
Yeah.
Of them. And
I mean, that was one fun thing about Space Jam is it was like, we, at that point, like, on Space, but it's when Space Jam had come out, there really hadn't been, like, everyone, you know, it was like, yeah, let's put those hillbillies in from Hillbilly Hair, and let's put, you know, it was like, there were characters that were appearing in that hadn't appeared in years
Pete
and years
Puma
before.
In the background sweeping up.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
So
like
many,
everywhere.
So much love for Pete Puma, I can't tell you.
Pete Puma so much. Everybody loves him.
But we put, you know, on the Looney Tunes show, too, on season two, we do have some characters that weren't in season one, like some cool classic characters that have that now have like kind of the Looney Tunes show take on them. Henry Hawk being one of them. So we did like this Henry Hawk kind of that Chicken Hawk rap song as one of the merry melodies in season one, and that people loved it, so that went over really well.
That sounds cool. So you guys were talking about Space Jam a lot. How is it doing live action slash cartoon a la Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Like, it's definitely the grandson of something like that.
Well, for a while, like in the, you know, in the 90s, that was really popular to do. And we'd worked on, you know, Spike had directed a whole bunch of commercials that had the characters.
Yeah, it was almost like doing one that had a cartoon background was almost.
Yeah, it got to the point where it was, it was like we were just so used to drawing them into live action worlds and putting them with live action people. We even did a Animaniacs. Remember, we did an Animaniacs commercial with them in live action.
Yeah, almost all the commercials
had
live action backgrounds and with you know, interacting with people. There's a lot of photo rotos that had to be made. And
yeah, it's pretty funny because, like, I guess it is a long time ago, but it doesn't seem that long ago. But the technology has changed so much that you know. I remember talking to some of the guys who made Roger Rabbit, and the thing to remember about Roger Rabbit, which is just a few years older than Space Jam, is that Space Jam was composited digitally in a computer, so you have a million different advantages. But Roger Rabbit wasn't. Yeah. Every scene, every frame of that movie.
The cameras and make sure they didn't move.
They actually did have moving.
Yeah, they had
cameras.
Moving cameras, right.
But they had all that stuff was done with. Mats and
so you had a character level. This is going to get really tedious and boring. But you know you had a character level, and then you had all kinds of different mats that provided the shadows and the highlights on those characters, and all of that stuff had to be on the same piece of film that went through the camera over and over again. There's a scene where Roger Rabbit's being interrogated, and they hit the light over their head, and that light is swinging around.
Yeah.
So that's not. You know, someone's animating that light passing over that character.
Right.
Not just that character, whoever's in that scene or whatever they're holding. And I think in that scene, there's something like that camera went through like 200 passes or something like that.
I was working up at Lucasfilm around that time, and they were doing a lot of that compositing and a lot of the camera work up there on the animation.
Yeah.
They were doing like the shadow work and the opticals and everything.
Right, so that's one piece of film that has to go through for every level, every pass, then back, and then through again. And it's like, you ask, you know, it's like, well, what happens if you just click two frames instead of one frame, and one level out of 200 is messed up? And it's like, the answer is you go back and start over again.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it happens, you know, those mistakes happen. So it's, that was a crazy...
Yeah.
Crazy amount of work to make that movie.
Yeah, and at the time it cost what, $60 million or something like that. You could now it would be like $260 million if you were making it with the same level of attention and detail and everything. But now it's easier to do that. You know.
It's easier to do, and that obviously the digital stuff really, you know, it really really helps.
Do you ever foresee a day where you could actually make a half hour, like a sitcom that is live action animation with that kind of those kind of effects and make it cost effective?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure. I mean, especially with, like, you know, primetime sitcoms have pretty healthy budgets, so.
Mm-hmm. So do the animated ones, too. So.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The animated shows have, I mean, they have a fair amount of money. You can do a live action animated combo.
Yeah.
But you couldn't 10 years ago.
No. No. I got some questions here on our Twitter feed.
Questions from the fans.
Here's one that says, from Dark Magician 399, which is the harder part, turning a script into a storyboard or using a storyboard in place of a script?
What's harder?
Yeah.
They're both hard.
Okay.
But I mean, I think
it
we said it earlier.
It depends on what you're
trying to do, and it depends on the show. There's kind of different methods for every show and every. It would be really hard for us to do a Looney Tunes show without a script, you know.
Right.
And it might be, really hard to do a Bob Clampett cartoon with by following a script or something like that. You know what I mean? It really depends on what you're trying to do.
I think it depends on the story you're trying to tell.
Right.
And if you've got a good idea for it.
And if it's mainly, the entertainment is mainly gags and stuff like that, it's probably easier to do.
Right. If it's all physical, or mostly physical.
Use a storyboard. That seems to make the most sense. And then you can figure out if your stuff is working rather than, you know, writing a script and then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really depends on what you're trying to do.
Well, yeah, I've known some animators who thought, like, working from a script is absolute anathema, but then, you know, the script they were working on was, like, a half-hour adventure involving a lot of vehicles and monsters and everything, and what they want to be doing is a short cartoon. So it's sort of like, okay, well, why are you here working on an adventure cartoon? This, you know, you need a script to go off.
I know a lot of people, and you know, cartoonists are be like almost anti-script, and that seems crazy to me. There's nothing I like more than starting a cartoon with a great script.
Mm.
It just makes everyone's life easier.
Yeah, I've worked both ways. On Tiny Toons, we did some experimenting where we took an outline and would give it to a director who had a, you know, certain vision and said, well, how about you know, this quick. You know, we need 6 minutes of business, and here's like a rough outline. And we got back, in some cases, we got back something great. In some cases, you know, we never saw the cartoon because, you know, in this one case, I gave it to one director who said, you know, we'd worked out the story together. And then, you know, a month later, when I go to look at the board, it's like, yeah, I threw that out way, you know, 3 weeks ago because I got a lot of other good ideas and I started working. And now I'm kind of on this way. Story's not working as I want it to, but I've got this great sequence planned for the end. I just kind of wondering how to get there. And I'm saying, like, why didn't you tell me you had thrown out the story in week two? Then we could have come up with something. And she goes, mm-hmm. And he said, well, I have better ideas, and I just sort of wanted to see where this was going. And I'm going, like, that's great if you've got kind of an open-ended budget and a lot of time, but, you know, I had to look at the board today, and I have to present the board, you know, tomorrow. So what do we got here? And the answer is nothing much.
I mean, I think the three of us, you know, we all kind of write and draw. You know what I mean? We all kind of pitch in different ways.
Yeah.
Depending on what the problem is. So you need both.
Yeah, I'd say you do. And I've heard people argue, like, well, they didn't need them in the old days and in this unit.
But we know they did. Yeah. I mean, you know what I mean? We have copies of Maltese's scripts, and his scripts were boards, you know, were rough storyboards. We're really rough storyboards, but the guy drew when he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So,
will Scooby-Doo ever die? I don't think he ever will.
No,
he'll outlive us all. Does Tony have any advice for ways storyboard artists can break into the business? What is the best way to showcase their skills? That's from my Cole Rothaker.
It sounds really stupid and easy, but the best way to break it in a business is to get really good at it before you start showing your, you know, before you try and get hired. And ways to get really good at it is to take classes, as many classes as you can, get copies of people's storyboard, like look at storyboards, study existing storyboards. Watch movies and figure out why movies were shot the way they were shot, and apply all of those things. But really, I mean, and draw. You have to study and draw.
Mm-hmm.
And
right now, I mean, you almost have to be a professional before.
Yeah, I know that's why I said it sounds too simple, but it's rough out there right now because. I think the training, you know, there are a lot more schools that offer training, and there are books out there, and there are websites, and so there's information out there to help you. But getting trained as a storyboard artist at a studio like Warner Brothers is impossible. You know, we have very kind of limited budgets and limited time, so we need to hire professionals. We can't bring people in anymore and train them. And I know they used to do stuff like that in the old days. So
mm-hmm.
you kind of got to be great before before you get hired, because you're immediately in competition with people who are very good at what
guys who've been in the business like 20 years or something.
Right. Yeah. And really those are the guys who are the guys who are always working are the guys who are really great. and girls.
And I mean, kind of the way that I got into storyboarding was just out of necessity. I mean, we were animating things, and then some show would come in where you needed something boarded, and then it's like, oh well, how do I even do this? Like it was kind of a weird, you know, back door, you know, that doesn't really exist anymore, where you're like, oh, I'm here for one reason, you know, to be an animator, and now I'm kind of getting,
yeah, because when we started on Warner Brothers stuff, both of us started as animators, and then in Chicago, but then when we moved here to Los Angeles, I've always loved storyboarding and kind of always loved storyboarding and kind of did study it, and even as a kid kind of oddly drew stuff that was kind of more in storyboard form than comic book form.
Uh-huh.
But once we got here, I know that they fell behind on some of the shows, and they said, does anyone know how to, you know, we're looking for storyboard freelance help, and I was like, I'll do it.
And
lucky enough that they let me do stuff without checking to see if I really knew what I was doing or not, because I probably didn't. But
you had enough to show them what.
Right, no, I did. Right, and I built up from there. It was just got a lucky break.
Yeah.
You mentioned you drew more in storyboard form than comic book form. What would be the major difference in your view between the two?
I think comic books, you know, obviously from where the, you know, you're thinking of camera placement and kind of like dynamic compositions and stuff like that, but you're not really thinking about would this cut, you know what I mean, like if this were shot like a film, could you cut it together and would it make sense, and for some reason I've always kind of thought about where is the camera, you know, and even when I wasn't doing it, I didn't even know I was a kid. I was never going to shoot anything, but I always kind of thought about it as a movie and like, so it just was kind of a weird natural thing.
Now everybody who's studying animation, I'm sure has watched, you know, the Disney classics and Miyazaki and, John Lasseter of Pixar and everything like that. What would you tell them to study as far as other filmmakers? Because it doesn't begin and end just looking at animation.
No, I definitely. You mean like just?
Well, I talked to a lot of guys who are you know, people who are starting careers in animation, and they have the enthusiasm, they have the love of cartoons that they've seen, but it's sort of like an artist who wants to draw superheroes and only looks back as far as Neil Adams.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to learn about storyboarding, watch Scorsese movies from the 80s and watch Coppola films.
What about Hitchcock?
Watch Hitchcock, who obviously, you know, was a very storyboard-driven director.
Mm-hmm.
Wells, Hitchcock. But really, watch The Godfather. Nothing cuts better. You know, I was watching, you know, watch Raging Bull and see how that movie cuts together. Mm-hmm. You know, like, just study it and watch the, you know, I went through this phase where I would go, especially like James, like I remember the first time we really had to start editing, we had to start boarding action scenes, and I had never really done it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started going, well, you know, I love James Cameron movies. I love the Terminator movies. And I love the way Cameron put an action scene together. So I would just go and take one, you know, this is back in the days when we had video printers, and I would just print out a frame from every one of his setups, and then just pin him up and look at him and go, why is he in this long shot here, and why is he in this medium shot here, and how does the camera move here? And it was like, once that stuff starts to seep in, it was like, oh my, there's a method behind, you know, there's a method to the madness.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, study films.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see when a live action director studies animation, and then you can see that they'll have borrowed certain ideas or gags or gimmicks from a cartoon film. I for whatever reason, I found myself, I was watching 1941 recently, and uh, I was I hadn't seen it in years. I don't think I'd, and this was like with a lot of other stuff cut in. And I'm going like, yeah, it's not a great movie, but it's got some set pieces that are kind of good, and or that I remembered as being kind of good. And I was watching this one sequence where it's in a dance, and Treat Williams plays this bully, and he's trying to punch out this kid who's dancing with this girl. And he's got Wendy Jo Sperber keeps running up to him and grabbing onto him. And I'm going like, I've seen this before. Not the movie before, but I know, shot by shot, this is a cartoon. And where is it from? Okay. It's from The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad. And during the party scene where Ichabod is dancing with Katrina Van Tassel, Brom Bones is trying to get away from this chubby little maid. And it's shot by shot with him screaming and giggling and grabbing him. And it's so interesting because there's also an homage to Dumbo in the movie, but you can tell that Spielberg, you know, remembered that scene, and it's like, okay, big lunky guy trying to get away from a little clutchy girl, and going like, damn, there it is. He just took that dance sequence and
wow. Well, it's like watching like The Matrix. Remember when The Matrix came out? It's like, man, those guys, you know, the Wachowskis really love anime. You could tell, you could, if you were familiar with it, it was like, shots totally shot for shot pulled out of stuff, and I not in a bad stealing kind of way, but just kind of in a loving, you know, embracing it kind of way. So
I mean, it's like you the whole history of film, you know, you take it in and you're always kind of referring back to something.
But it's like there's scenes in Raging Bull that I can't remember. I know if you watch in the DVD extra material, like Scorsese will go through it and go, this is from The Searchers. This is from this. This is from that. This is from... And it's like, he's telling you the stuff that moved him as a, you know... And it's like, he didn't forget it and then put it in a boxing movie. If he's taking like John Ford shots and putting them in boxing movies, like... Mm-hmm. You know, this stuff is kind of interchangeable.
Things. I was watching a comparison to Untouchables, and like the scene where the baby carriage goes downstairs is directly. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
It is. But that's and this is long-winded advice, but if it's good enough for Martin Scorsese to study films and figure out shots and why things work, then that's it. That's the secret.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think they're, that should be part of everybody's workbook, looking at classic movies, both animated and live action, and coming up with those references. It just makes it stronger, especially in cartoons where you can kind of take those moments and caricature them a little bit. It just makes it more for impact. Okay. We're back after a cookie break. Allison, let me put you on the spot for a second. Can you talk about... Oh, then you're finishing up a cupcake.
As I eat my cupcake,
Sorry. Can you fill us in a little bit on what it was like to work with Tim Burton on Frankenweenie?
It was really pretty wonderful because Frankenweenie really is such a... It's such a personal story to him. So, I mean, this is something that has been kicking around his head since he was kind of the age of Victor Frankenstein in the story. So it was really great to kind of try and get that experience and that movie kind of out of his imagination. Because it does take place in a town called New Holland, which is kind of like Burbank where he grew up. And there's lots of those little things. So it was really fun. And he's on every frame. So
That was originally a student film he'd made at CalArts, is that right?
No, he did it at Disney, actually.
Oh, Disney. Okay,
that's right. He was first at Disney, and he originally set out to kind of make it as a movie, and then kind of got the ability to make it as a live-action short. So, it kind of was the thing that started his whole live-action career was that short. So it was pretty pivotal.
I do like the idea of it going into his, like, you know, background of Burbank and stuff, because that was my favorite part of Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
Was CalArts and the growing up in Valencia and all the houses that looked the same. Absolutely. And the castle up on the hill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We call it suburban Gothic. It's that juxtaposition of, you know, it's the people who look so normal that really are the monsters, and the monsters aren't so bad. So
I don't know. If you have avocado shag rugs, you are a monster.
Yes.
And wear polyester pants and have those little weird gold things on the walls.
We do have grapes. We have the glass grapes was our real
had to have it in the house. Because it does take place sort of in the 70s. It's pretty much takes place in like the early 70s when he would have been young. And so there's lots of... It was fun to kind of make a movie about Southern California in England with people who have never been to Southern California. And then the whole end of the movie is this kind of... in order to get a angry Dutch mob to chase Sparky up to a windmill, we set it in this town called New Holland, at which the little town kind of goes nuts for Dutch things. So trying to tell an English crew how to do Dutch for Southern California in the 70s, it was like, nope, that's too Dutch.
It's so it's like less Solvang Dutch. A little
it's
bit.
It's like Solvang, and they have no concept of what even a place that a place like Solvang can exist. So I took lots of photos and brought to him, no, there really is a windmill on every corner, and everything is it's strangely Dutch. But yeah, so that was fun.
Awesome. And it's in black and white too, right?
It is absolutely in black and white.
That is brave. Haven't seen him do that since Ed Wood, right?
Yeah, you know, it was such a huge part of the storytelling is to make it in black and white, because it is such an homage to all the films that he loved as a kid. So it really was never a question. It was always going to be in black and white. And it's going to be strange to see a movie in black and white, and like a minute into it, you don't even realize it's in black and white.
Well, so. Was it actually filmed in black and white, or was it?
We filmed it on. We used digital still cameras, and so we actually capture regular color. But because color was playing such tricks with the black and white, once we pulled the color out, that we ended up actually painting most everything, or everything we could paint in black and white and shades of gray. So it was kind of a weird thing to kind of go on the set and be like, everything is gray, puppets are gray. Sets are black and white, so it was neat.
Any hard greens like a young Frankenstein used to make the really whited out grays or anything like that?
No, we thought that we would say like, what color will play well, and it turned out that it was doing our heads, and nothing was especially maybe with the digital, nothing played nicely. Like this particular red would look perfect in one and then look absolutely wrong in another one. So we started out by painting things with regular color and then actually decided against, and it just quickly moved on to shades of gray and their values.
It seems like other studios might have balked at making a movie like that, both stylistically and in black and white, but it seems to me that Disney has kind of realized in a very savvy way that they have kind of a lock on that market ever since Nightmare Before Christmas. And especially, I was down at their downtown Disney, a lot of things seem to be kind of geared toward not really a hard-edged goth, but a little more of a darker sensibility. And it seems like Frankenweenie, you know, kind of fits that really...
Yeah, they've been great. They really have embraced it and are excited about it and didn't get too scared by the black and white of it all. So I do think that they get that it's... In fact, we previewed it for people, and literally when we ask if they think that this is a Disney movie, audiences are saying absolutely, because it's a movie with enormous heart. Yeah, so it's like this great love story between a boy and his dog, and so it doesn't even feel like a strange fit for Disney, because it really has that something that people consider a Disney staple. So yeah, we'll see. Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
I'm a big fan of black and white dogs, so
you are. I mean, you got good ones.
Yeah, here are a couple for me. Bryce McKean wants to know, if you were going to write a Zatanna movie script, what would the story be? About a girl who talks backwards and weird things happen. Something, I think that would definitely be part of it. What was it like to write work on Batman Mask of the Phantasm? What are your thoughts on the film? I love it. I think it turned out really well. It was a challenge, and you know, all props to Alan Burnett for holding the things together.
Yeah.
It was really... It was a fun movie. And Tower Prep, what is going to happen with this great show? Well, it is going to exist fondly in memories of fans like yourself. Thank you very much for asking, and I guess that's all that's ever going to happen with it. What's the holdup with all the DC films? And ask if you can write the next Batman movie. No, I won't do that. The reason for that is I Alan Burnett and I once took a shot at a Batman Beyond movie script, and... didn't really enjoy the process of working on it, and I don't think I'm going to write a live-action superhero movie, not about an established character. I think it's too difficult and the stakes are too high, so I don't want to get into it more than that. Oh, here's one from Tooth. Did Tiny Toons really end due to creepy fans?
I think it ended because they'd made over 100 of them.
Yeah, I think at that point everybody was kind of sick of them, and Animaniacs had come along. And
really, the creepy fans are no creepier than they are of any other cartoon.
That's right.
Yeah, I didn't hear about a creepy fan. Yeah, I don't know.
Is there especially creepy fans of Tiny Toons?
Somebody send in something, or the head of Buster.
Yeah. Minerva Mink?
No, she was Animaniacs, but yeah, there are plenty of Minerva Mink fans out there. Every show gets its, I'd say, fringe element, but that doesn't really cause a show from going off the air. But Tiny Toons and Animaniacs had very passionate fans, and some who might have been a little too passionate about certain elements, and some who weren't.
Yeah, we're lucky the fringe element exists. Most of our shows are mostly heavily endorsed by the fringe element.
But I mean, Tiny Toons did. I mean, they did 100.
They did over 100 cartoons, right?
Well, nowadays
wasn't 13 right. something episode 100?
I think it might have been.
Yeah,
and we it's like that at that point, I mean, you can run those every day, and you've got you won't run into the same cartoon for quite a while. So
that's the argument they make, is that now 52 is sort of the cutoff number, even 39 for some shows. They're done in increments of 13, so or there's
what is now it like? It's now 26 is a pretty common order. So if you do two seasons of 26, you're at
52,
and you might be done with it. So
and then they take the 26 and they split it into seasons of 13. Sometimes, don't they? Or it's weird.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, it used to be in the old days with the Saturday morning cartoons is that the order was 13, and that way you would, because they only ran them on Saturdays, you'd run them four times in a year.
Right.
There's really no rhyme or reason, or at least reason I understand, of how things are run or when they're run or what constitutes a season. I mean, it's it's really kind of up in the air and up for grabs right now.
Yeah, because I've seen everything from like running two episodes as a premiere, and then you don't see anything for 3 months. Then they run those two episodes and four others, and that's mini season one. And then it goes off the air for 6 months, and then it comes back.
Yeah, I know. People are always asking us, when is something coming back, and how long are breaks going to be? And we have no answer. We have no idea. We have no idea when anything's going to be on.
Do you ever foresee the return of classic Saturday morning? The Saturday morning block, like on NBC, CBS, something like that.
It'd be great, but I don't think so. I just think Saturday morning has changed. I think kids are busy on Saturday morning.
Yeah. I also think that because there's so many channels that, what I always hear is the network saying, well, why should we bother with Saturday morning? They'll just watch it on Nickelodeon.
Yeah, when I was a kid, it was like, okay, what's on NBC? Okay, nothing good on ABC. Okay, well, I'll check Fox, and and that was it. That's all we had.
Yeah.
Oh, Soul Train's on. My afternoon's done.
Yeah. Yeah, go out and play.
That's very true.
Yeah, I miss classic Saturday morning, but, it's like, it gets into the whole thing of, like, fans will gravitate toward a certain show, and they'll say, you only did 52 episodes, why didn't you do more? It's like it doesn't become profitable after that. Yeah. That's the thing. It's like you look back at how many Yogi Bear episodes are there? Like 30,
And then, well, the Jetsons, what is it, like 22 or something like
something
that?
Something like that. Wow, there are 30 episodes of Top Cat, Wow. They just ran them forever. And every time there was an opening on Saturday morning, they take one of those primetime shows that only ran a season and then just run it there. The characters achieve their longevity through constant, one generation goes up, okay, and then we're going to show Huckleberry Hound on Saturday morning, and kids who have never seen it before are going to, learn who these characters are. I mean, I think it would be great if every show that had a big fan following could run like The Simpsons and just do, 20 years worth of episodes. But, I don't know. There's the go crazy factor if you...
Yeah, I know. What
do you do with these guys?
So our podcast is pretty friendly to voiceover actors. Do you guys get to work with the voiceover actors on your shows that much?
We've been really lucky to work with all kinds of, people that are heroes of ours over the years on you know, we had a lot of great voices on Duck Dodgers. We've had a lot of great voices on Mystery Incorporated. We have great voices on a Looney Tunes show. I mean, we've been very lucky to work with some really kind of famous and cool people. Spike, do you have any favorites?
I think it's just, you know, it's just fun to actually meet some of these people. You know, we had Brian Wilson on, playing himself on Duck Dodgers.
That was right. Really cool.
We had, you know, Tom Jones did the the theme song for Duck Dodgers with the Flaming Lips, and so
and he came back and played himself.
Came back and played himself on the show.
Yeah,
and you know, those are it's just fun to meet those people. And have them be a part of your show and you know, part of your life.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we've had a lot of directors come in to do voices, like Kevin Smith came in to do a voice on Dodgers, and Quentin Tarantino came in to do a voice Dodgers.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of, like, fun off casting. We had the Brian Wilson episode was a really kind of special episode to me, and there's only been like two circumstances where I was really worried, like to the point of losing sleep over it, and one was Brian Wilson, because I really didn't want anything to go wrong and I wanted Brian to be comfortable and I wanted that to be a good experience.
Yeah, he's had a bad enough life as it is.
But I was really worried about it, like I just wanted that guy to go, this was fun, you know, and I was worried about it, and I wanted everything to come off. And then the other guy was Henry Winkler, because he came on to do a voice on Dodgers, and I was as a kid, I was such an enormous Happy Days fan.
Sure.
Like an enormous Happy Days fan, and I just thought, if Fonzie is on the show and he's mean to me, it will crush me. It will crush me forever. But I mean, we're happy to say that Henry Winkler, if there's actually anyone cooler than Fonzie, it's Henry Winkler.
He is a very nice
not,
man.
Right. He
very,
could not have
very
been,
sweet guy.
He could not have, that could not have gone better, and he could not have been cooler.
And I think on that day, there was some sort of a class was there.
Uh-huh.
And so the whole recording booth was full of,
it was a
like,
voiceover,
extra,
right. It was
extra people. And he was so nice to everybody. He shook everybody's hand and then, you know, introduced himself. And then while they were you know setting up, he sat down next to me, and he actually called me Spikeroo. And I think on Happy Days, he had a nephew named Spike, and I believe that's what he called him on there.
Oh, that's awesome.
And you know, Gary Marshall, who created Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, plays Dr. Weisberg on the Looney Tunes show. And so our Happy Days world is very close.
We got to use a favorite band of mine, Riders in the Sky.
Yeah, that was a ton of
Duck
fun.
Dodgers. That was great. That was sort of an homage to the Pecos Bill segment of Melody Time, where Roy Rogers comes in and sings the song about Pecos Bill, and we have Dodgers acting like a Western hero, and so they're singing about all these impossible feats that he did. That was directly inspired by Pecos Bill, and they actually took the song, and they scored it, kind of like they. I remember I wrote the lyrics to it,
Marcus
kind of set it to music. Yeah. And then they took it and they recorded it in Nashville and sent it in. It was
it was great.
Those guys are
fun guys.
Yeah,
we had Burt Reynolds and Don DeLuise came in.
Really?
Oh wow! Yeah,
to do an episode.
Oh yeah.
And it was one of those things where. It was a special sort of night record session.
Yeah.
Nice.
Because Bert was filming
the longest yard remake. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And so, but it was great to see those two guys together. And it took forever to record their lines because they had so many great stories to tell. And
then when it was done, we actually just kind of hung around with them, and they told us stories and did goofy little bits together. Like, that was just like a great night, because it was it was just a night hanging around with Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise. It was perfect.
Yeah.
Tom DeLuise reminds me. I got to meet him and Phyllis Diller, and Phyllis Diller just recently passed.
Yeah.
She did a Scooby-Doo movie where she was a guest star. Have you guys ever thought about doing things like that, where they have the guest star?
Oh,
like,
we had Harlan Ellison on Mystery Incorporated as himself. We've only
the
had.
Whole thing.
That's the only. In season two, another person plays themselves on the show. I can't really say who it is yet.
Okay.
But Harlan Ellison was on as Harlan Ellison.
You had Batman and Robin, Three Stooges back then. Some great teams like Don Knotts and stuff.
Yeah. Well, Harlan fits in with
all those. Yeah, definitely.
If he fits in with the Harlem Globetrotters and Mama Cass.
There's such a crossover, because I did a Brave and Bold with Scooby-Doo in it, and with Al Yankovic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You wrote that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, and we used the old 70s versions of the Penguin and the Joker.
Was great.
Sherlock had some great people.
Yeah, Holmes had
Malcolm McDowell.
Malcolm McDowell played Moriarty.
And nice. Michael York.
Sherlock Holmes. And Jonathan Rhys Davies was Watson.
Wow.
And they were great. And man, what pros.
Great. Well, this was great. I mean, I think we got to wrap it up for this week. But you want to come back again next week or in the near future and do it again?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
This was a ton of fun.
You have to come back a year from now because, the three of us have a little something in the works.
Yeah.
Can't really talk about it now, but.
But very soon.
Very soon.
And it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll leave it at that. Let your imagination wander. Thanks, guys. Spike, Tony, Spencer, Allison. Looking forward to Scooby-Doo, Looney Tunes, Frank and Weenie, everything. Wealth of stuff coming out soon. Thanks again, guys, and talk to you later.
Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter @RadioRashi or @Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.